This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Those behind these messages are warned that inciting violence is a criminal offense. Members of the public are cautioned against spreading such divisive messages.
That's South African Police Ministry spokesperson Liradzu Temba on pamphlets and social media messages spreading around the country calling for mass protests. Details coming up. Also, President Kais Saied promises to form a new government according to the will of the Tunisian people. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. There are concerns of a new wave of public violence in South Africa this week. Security forces say they are on high alert after pamphlets and social media messages spread around the country this weekend calling for mass protests. The calls apparently emanate from KwaZulu-Natal, the home province of former President Jacob Zuma. Mobs began looting stores and destroying infrastructure in several cities last month, killing about 350 people and causing billions of dollars in damage. This after Zuma was jailed for contempt of court. Darren Taylor reports.
Thousands of police and soldiers are hitting the streets to prevent possible outbreaks of violence. The biggest deployments are in Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. A few weeks ago, the worst public unrest since the end of apartheid in 1994 happened in these two provinces, in which the two major cities of Johannesburg and Durban are situated. Police Ministry spokesperson Liradzu Temba says law enforcement agencies have put measures in place to protect citizens who accused the police of doing little to stop last month's mayhem. In a recorded message to media, Temba said this time, the security agencies, collectively known as the National Joint Operations and Intelligence Structure, or NAT joints, are ready for anything.
The NAT joints is aware of inflammatory messages on various social media platforms advocating for violence. Those behind these messages are warned that inciting violence is a criminal offense. Members of the public are cautioned against spreading such divisive messages.
According to the NAT Joint's operational plan, seen by VOA, security forces will guard national key points such as airports and the state broadcaster, along with police stations, prisons, and shopping centers. Some of the pamphlets accuse President Cyril Ramaphosa of selling out the poor by favoring white capitalists. Temba says other messages urge citizens to shut the country down.
The public is urged not to respond to calls for violence and criminality and are thus discouraged from participating in activities that seek to defy the rule of law and to undermine the authority of the state.
The African National Congress, or ANC, in KwaZulu-Natal makes no secret of its support for Zuma, who's accused of mass corruption. ANC Provincial Representative Nhlakanipho Ntombela acknowledges that some of the pamphlets bear what appears to be the stamp of the ANC Provincial Office.
We've been aware of a pamphlet circulating and want to put it on record that as the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal were not party to any of those activities. Those who have done that thing, they've done on their own. They with not authority of the ANC in the province.
Ntombela says just because the ANC in the province backs Zuma doesn't mean it's trying to destabilize the Ramaphosa government.
We can assure the people of South Africa, we don't know who's organizing and who's behind it. In fact, we are warning those individuals that using an ANC logo on an illegal activity is a criminal offense against the organization.
He says the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal would never advocate violence to achieve a political objective in a democratic country.
It can't be done on the ANC name. Whereas if you understood what happened during the last incident of looting and everything, it can't be done in the name of the former President Zuma.
In July, law enforcement agencies ignored social media messages inciting violence until it was too late. Not this time, says Temba.
Law-abiding citizens should be at ease knowing that the NetJoint is not taking these threats lightly. Security forces are on high alert and are ready to maintain stability in the country and will ensure the safety and security of South Africans.
Meanwhile, it's taken more than a month for Ramaphosa to say what citizens have known all along, that his administration was poorly prepared for last month's attempted insurrection, as he describes it. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Nearing the end of his 30-day suspension of parliament, Tunisian President Kais Saied says a new government will be formed soon according to the will of the Tunisian people and the path they have chosen. But he says whoever thinks that we will go back is delusional, referring to reviving the frozen parliament's activity. Saied's simultaneous dismissal of the prime minister gained widespread popular support, but he has yet to appoint a replacement or announce plans to manage the next phase of his reforms. Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project on Middle East Democracy, discussed the situation on Press Conference USA with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi and host Carol Castiel.
President Kais Saied is in no rush to reopen the parliament. I would be very shocked if the parliament is reopened within this 30-day window. I think it's very likely that he will continue the freezing of parliament and continue his sort of powers and his rule under these exceptional authorities that he's given himself past the 30-day deadline. He seems to, I would assume he's looking at the polling numbers and seeing there's strong public support and probably doesn't feel a huge amount of pressure coming from inside Tunisia to sort of act more quickly to return to what the situation was before. And he's also made it very clear when he was running for president, since he's been in office, and in the past several weeks, that he really thinks that a significant remaking of the constitution, of the Tunisian political system, is in order. So I personally do not expect him to be reopening parliament anytime soon. It's also useful for him politically that parliament is so unpopular among Tunisians and has kind of been made the scapegoat for all of Tunisia's problems. And so it's in Kais Saied, you know, it's good for him politically to keep the parliament sort of in the spotlight as this dysfunctional entity. Now, if he continues for a long period of time without a parliament, that parliament is duly elected, freely elected, just as President Kais Saied was. And so Tunisia will cease to be a democracy if one of its freely and fairly elected institutions of government is shut down by the president and stopped from working. It will not be a democracy at that point. And right now, I wouldn't say it's a democracy. It's somewhere in between. It's in a period of flux and transition. But without a parliament that's freely elected, able to do its job, you can't really describe that political system as a democracy. At least I wouldn't.
But would he change the political system into a presidential one?
Oh, you know, it's unclear. I should underscore that there's a lot of uncertainty and lack of clarity about what he has in mind for his near-term steps, for this roadmap that he's promised that hasn't been forthcoming, and what his vision is beyond that for the Tunisian economy, for the Tunisian political system. It's not clear. We can just go on comments and remarks and discourse that he's made over the years, and especially more recently. It seems clear that he has a strong antipathy toward political parties. He strongly believes in bottom-up governance and what some would call, quote-unquote, radical decentralization, which would start with elected local councils and then kind of build the political system up from there. At the same time, he also seems to believe in very strong powers of the presidency and a system perhaps that is more akin to what existed under past presidents Bourguiba and Ben Ali, a very sort of dominant presidency. So how that vision of a dominant, or some would say overbearing, presidency will square with his ideas also of radical decentralization, it remains to be seen. It's not necessarily the most coherent vision, at least as he's laid it out so far. We just have a sense of his impulses, that he does not like political parties. He doesn't seem very favorably inclined toward a strong and independent parliament. He wants to have these local actors sort of form themselves into governing bodies at the local level. And he seems to believe in a very strong role for the presidency. And if he wants to act on that vision, it will mean a remaking of the Tunisian constitution.
That was Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project on Middle East Democracy, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy and host Carol Castiel on Press Conference USA. Malawi's Supreme Court of Appeal says the death penalty remains constitutional in the Southern African country. The decision reverses a ruling from just 4 months ago when the same court abolished the death penalty. Rights campaigners say the development is disappointing. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The ruling in April stemmed from the petition of a convicted murderer who wanted the Supreme Court to rehear his case. Justice Dunstan Maunguru said Malawi's constitution respects the right to life and said the death penalty negates that right. He emphasized the sanctity of life, saying without the right to life, other rights do not exist. Justice Maunguru also ordered the resentencing of all cases where the death penalty was handed down. However, in a document released this week, the other Supreme Court justices say Mwangulu's ruling only expressed his personal opinion. Justice Anaclet Chipeta says he dissociates himself from the judgment because it did not reflect the views of the majority of the appeal court justices. Another justice, Rezin Nzikamanda, said the issue of constitutionality of the death penalty was not part of the case they were handling. Peter Dimba is chairperson of the legal committee of Malawi's parliament.
The views of the majority of the judges on the panel would actually guide the day, because that's what it means. So as it stands, it means the death penalty still stands.
Mike Okayatsa is executive director for the Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation in Malawi. He says although the justices have valid reasons for not backing Mwangulu's opinion, the Malawi government needs to move quickly to formally abolish the death penalty.
We think Malawi has an obligation under international human rights law to ensure that it complies with that resolution. But also we know that Malawi has not executed anybody since the 90s. So the country needs to continue on that path. But we need a lasting solution, and that's why we think that a way should be found to repeal this death penalty.
The death penalty has long been mandatory in Malawi for those convicted of murder or treason and optional for rape. Court records show that 27 people are under a death sentence in Malawi. However, according to Amnesty International, Malawi last carried out an execution in 1992 when 12 people were hanged. Lawmaker Dimba noted that many countries are abolishing death penalty. He said his parliamentary committee would opt for abolishing the death penalty if the proposal came to parliament in the form of a bill.
This is an issue that is supposed to be done by government. If they see it fit, they can actually bring an amendment bill to parliament. And I don't think parliament would have problems abolishing the death penalty.
However, some critics say abolishing the death penalty may lead to an increase in acts of mob justice. In December 2020, a mob killed a 47-year-old man in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, who had allegedly killed another man suspected to have raped his daughter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Bandits have released 15 more students who were among 100 snatched July 5th from Bethel Baptist High School in the town of Damshi in northwest Nigeria. That brings the number of released students to about 70. Officials told Reuters yesterday that parents paid an undisclosed ransom to free the students. President Muhammadu Buhari in February urged state governments to stop paying bandits, and Kaduna Governor Nasir El-Rufai publicly refuses to pay. But desperate parents and communities offered to raise and pay ransoms themselves. Armed bandits seeking ransom have abducted more than 1,000 students from schools in northwest Nigeria since December, and Kaduna State schools remain closed due to the threat. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of South Kivu province has suspended operations at 6 mines operated by Chinese companies. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti, who is based in Goma in the eastern DRC, tells my colleague Kate Pond-Dawson the governor acted after civil society groups complained of abuses at the mines. He says the suspension is temporary to give the government, the workers, community leaders, and the mine operators time to set new rules to protect workers' rights.
It's because the surrounding villages and locals were talking about human rights abuse from the owner and leaders of their company and cooperative, which are Chinese citizens working in DRC. The minister, in the last week, on 15th August, the minister of the National Minister of Mining Sector was in Bukavu, and she talked with a thematic working group on mining from the civil society of South Kivu, who presented an advocacy note to the minister with the subject, the looting of mineral resource by Chinese subjects in Mwenga territory. And from that, many revelation was known from the locals to the governor. For example, companies was using soldiers to force people to work in their mining sector. They also use soldiers to work themselves in mining sector and to abuse the human rights.
What are people saying about the decision to suspend the mine operations?
People appreciate it. I myself talked to the local chief of Basile, who was the first to let people know about what is going in his ground. He's very happy. And also the team, the president of the civil society, made a note to give thanks to the governor and to the national minister to take that decision. For the people, it's a way to arrange their working grounds, and they are happy of that because they know that they will not lose work or job, because after arranging everything, all mining sites will open again.
What have the owners or the operators of the suspended mines said? Have they denied the allegations? Have they responded to the government's suspension?
All of them are not saying anything. When this suspension happened, we tried to contact them, but no one accepted to answer our questions.
That was Jafar Akatanti in Goba. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Kenya's Court of Appeal has ruled that a plan by President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga to change the constitution is unlawful. Muhammad Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
The 7-judge bench issued its ruling Friday. Justice Gatembu Kairu said the power to change the constitution lies with the citizens, not the political elite.
Abolishing or abrogating provisions of the constitution in such a way as to alter its foundation and structure is therefore not envisaged under Chapter 16 of the constitution. That is a preserve of the people exercising sovereign power, which belongs to them in accordance with Article 1 of the constitution.
Kenyatta and Odinga unveiled what they called the Building Bridges Initiative in 2018, a year after a hotly contested election almost split the country. The proposed changes will create more political positions, greatly increase the amount of government revenue going to the county level, and allow politicians to simultaneously serve as members of parliament and as members of the government. However, Justice Hannah Okwengu said there was no public participation in the process of changing the constitution.
No evidence was laid before the court to prove that there was any meaningful public participation before the collection of signatures in support of the proposed constitutional amendments.
In January, the Electoral Commission verified what supporters of the amendment had collected, the 1.1 million signatures required to move it forward. However, Justice Francis Tuiyot said the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission was not properly constituted when verifying those signatures. The IEBC had only three commissioners, less than a majority, when it gave the green light.
To hold that the quorum could be anything less than half of the membership of seven is to weaken the commission. It is common ground that IEBC formulated administrative procedures to guide on the verification of signatures in support of a constitutional amendment. There can be little doubt that formulation of such guidelines will be the business of the commission, given the critical importance of that threshold in a popular initiative process, and the commission needed to be quorate.
Odinga, in a statement posted on Twitter, said he accepts the court ruling. It is likely that this is not the end of the conversation, and the parties involved will each make their own decision on how to proceed from the decision that has been delivered today, Odinga said. Odinga said this week he won't challenge the ruling at the Supreme Court. Political commentator Martin Andati says today's ruling has made it difficult for politicians to form a government for the few.
They wanted to expand the executive so that it makes it very easy for them. But you see, that has now collapsed. So that is good also for the country, because now for you to be able to win an election, you must look for a clever way of bringing everybody on board and making sure that all those interests which support you are catered for.
Kenya is scheduled to conduct a general election in August of next year. The East African nation has witnessed a heated electoral process over the years, leading to killings and large-scale displacement of people from their homes. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo, and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.